All right. Well, here we go. So I can't remember the last time I was in here. I think it was April. It's been a long time. So jumping back into Revelation for me was a big jump, and I had to get my mind back in the game. I know Joel did Revelation 16, but I don't know how many weeks ago that was. So I don't know where your minds are right now. Like, when's the last time we were in Revelation in this class? It's been a little while? Oh, just a couple weeks. Okay, so you guys are probably much more, like I said, fresh than where I was before I started this study. But what I thought would be helpful for us, and again, not going to do the whole thing, but do a little review, especially for people that are new to the class, they aren't up to Revelation. We're in Revelation 17. So, I mean, we're at the end, you know? So if this is your first time in the class, or like me, you're jumping back in, it's like, Revelation 17? Good grief. So I thought maybe do a quick review, not to take up. I really want to get into this whole, the fall of Babylon in Revelation 17 today. But I think a good review would get us there, and then it would give us 2 weeks to get through basically 17 and 18. And I think that would be plenty of time to study it and to understand it. Oh, yeah. I want to tell you, there's a little table in the back right there in the middle, I guess. Yeah, right there. Julie's pointing at it. There are some little booklets. There's the John MacArthur booklet there. It's called A Jet Tour Through Revelation. Those are free. You can have one of those if you want. That's something we had bought for the college group a while back. And I just thought it was appropriate if you guys want them. So take those. Don't take the other things, though, but you can look at them. But those are some things. I'm going to refer to some of those books as I teach. And I just thought that would be another thing, too, is maybe like have a little resource table there. So if you are like, man, I want to learn more about that, then I'll try to bring in some books that have been helpful or something like that. But back there are a couple of commentaries I just feel like are two really great commentaries, especially on this chapter, and then a couple of other books that I'll refer to, and you can flip through those and look at those. But I kind of opened a couple of them up to the pages that I thought were really helpful. So that stuff will be back there for you, I guess, each week. I don't know. I'm making it up as I go, so we'll see if there's something bad there next week. So when we study Revelation, and this is what I said last time we started studying, or I started studying with you guys, and I just want to remind everyone, I mean, studying end times is always fascinating, you know, because you're looking at what God, who knows all things, has said about the future, something that we have no ability to discern or know, you know what I mean? And so there's that thing in us that wants to know the future. I mean, that's where astrology and all these many things, you know, palm reading and all these people just want to know what's going to happen most of the time because they want to know how it affects them and what they need to prepare for, you know, in their life sort of thing. But God has told us the end so that we know how to rightly live in the present. Not so that we can go around thinking that, you know, I know things that people don't know, or just for a fascinating mind game and you're like, what does that mean? I wonder how that plays out, you know, in history. But it's for us to understand what's going on right now and where all that is heading so that it can pull, basically help us to see correctly in this life. Because what happens is we get nearsighted and we do start focusing on what our struggles are or our life or where we're going to be or whether we're comfortable or living a good, whatever it is, and it takes our mind off the end game. And I think Daniel, Revelation, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Zechariah, all these end times books, just it kind of pulls away the fog and goes, this is where you're heading. This is where all of creation is going. And so are you living faithful to Christ now? Makes sense. That's why that's what we want to get out of this. And that being said, it is fascinating and it is really exciting to study. But again, we never want to miss the picture or the big picture of what's going on here. And so that's the importance of Revelation. It exposes the evil and the that's going on in the world around us, the satanic origin of all religions, philosophies, ideologies, and worldviews. We're going to talk about that with Babylon. It reveals that all of these things are purposed to oppose God's truth. All of these things are doctrines of demons. Because again, in our, you know, in the humanistic way of thinking, it's all religions are fine and they all lead to the same place, or, you know, they believe what they believe and you believe what you believe. But according to God's truth, it's not like that at all. There is one truth, and all other things are a lie against the truth. And they're all come from one source and one system, and they're all purposed for one evil purpose, to keep people from the gospel of Jesus Christ. And to keep people in bondage to their sin. So the Revelation is full of warnings to flee from sin, to cling to Jesus Christ. It's full of reminders for those who read it that they will gain insight into the blessings of God and the promises of Christ. And that's something, you know, actually the Revelation itself reminds us to read it for that purpose. If you look at Revelation 1:19, John basically lays out, or Christ tells John what he's going to reveal to John for the purpose of John not only himself knowing these things, but proclaiming them to the churches so that the churches, both the seven churches in Ephesus that he's writing directly to, and every church throughout history, including us, can read these things and understand these truths so that we can live rightly before the Lord. Revelation 1:19 is kind of a purpose statement out at the beginning. He says, Christ says to John, therefore write these things which you have seen, talking specifically about what is happening right there on the island of Patmos, and the things which are, which is basically what's going on in the seven churches that he's writing to currently, and the things which will take place after these things, which is everything from Revelation 4 to 22. Those are the things that will take place afterwards, in the end. And that's where we're at now. We're in the middle of all the end time stuff. But that's kind of how you can look at Revelation. Revelation 1 is what John saw on the island of Patmos, and he writes that down. Revelation 2 through 3 are the messages that Christ wants to send to the seven churches that are currently existing in Asia Minor at the time. And he writes them, and he tells them, he prays, you know, he says, it's good that you're doing this, but then he says, this part of your church is not okay, and repent, and make sure you're doing the right thing, or there's consequences, basically. And the only two churches that don't follow that formula perfectly, well, I guess three, is Smyrna and Philadelphia, because he basically tells them, you're about to endure and suffer and even die. Just keep clinging to me. And then, what's the last one? Laodicea. He doesn't give them any praise. He just says that, yeah.
When you say, therefore, write the things that you have seen,
mm-hmm.
That is the vision he had of Christ.
Yes. I think that's currently what he's seeing on Patmos. You know, when Christ appears and the glory and the burnished bronze feet and all that, and it sounds like many waters and all that, yeah.
Basically the first 18 verses.
Yes. Okay. Yep. And so that's just kind of a way to look at it. So that's basically what's going on in Revelation. And Henry Morris in his commentary, and I know we've talked about this before, stressed that Revelation means unveiling, not veiling. You know, people take the book of Revelation and they make it mean whatever they want it to mean. And there's so many different interpretations. And whether and honestly, in the very end, if you just start with a solid a hermeneutic, you use the same hermeneutic that you use to study any other part of the Bible, and it can't just mean anything. It must mean something. Now, there's definitely things that Revelation says that we don't understand how that will play out historically, like what the, you know, you can't go, oh, that's going to look like this, and this is exactly how it's going to happen. But it will happen exactly like he says it will happen. Does that make sense? So you're not looking at it going, I wonder if the locusts are helicopters. No, it's not. You don't have to do that. But what he says is going to happen. And it's going to be exactly like he says it. And I always say, I think one of the best ways to understand future prophecy is to look at historical prophecy that's already happened. Prophecies that happened in the past, but they've already been fulfilled in some sense. And we can look back on those fulfillments and see that God did exactly what he said in that prophecy. Does that make sense? And that helps you to understand. So he's going to do, that's how God proclaims something that will happen and then acts it out in history the way that he says it. It doesn't mean that you know, there's going to be figurative and symbolic language and things like that, but it happens in a literal way. Does that make sense? So he can use figurative language. He can use poetic language. He can use symbolic language, but that doesn't mean it can mean anything. It means one thing, and there's enough in prophecy that's already been fulfilled for you to see how God does proclaim the future and then fulfills that promise, and then you can apply that same kind of hermeneutic to the future, and you can see this must happen the way he says it's going to happen, but there's still symbolic language. So a real quick review, if you haven't been here, Revelation 1, like we said, is Jesus appears to John on Patmos and tells him to write this stuff down. And Jesus appears in his glory. John falls down before him. He sees Christ in his glory. Revelation 2 and 3 are seven messages. They're like seven little epistles to seven churches in Asia Minor. You know what I mean? So think about like the book of Galatians, book of Ephesians, that sort of stuff. It's like, but it's tiny. And so Christ is saying, this is what the church needs to hear currently. So Revelation 2 and 3 are the messages to the churches. And like we said, Revelation 4 through 22 is everything that happens afterwards. I didn't put all this up there because I don't think, I just didn't want to dig too deep in this and waste too much time. But basically, you can look at the whole flow of the rest of Revelation in six parts. From chapter 4 to the beginning of chapter 8, you have seven seal judgments. From chapter basically 8 through halfway through 11, you have seven trumpet judgments that come out of the seventh seal. So think about the seven seals is all the judgment of God. And then it's like he takes a microscopic view into that seventh seal, and that's your seven trumpets. And then you go into that seventh trumpet, and those are your seven bowls of wrath. But those, the seven seals, trumpets, and bowls, that's the full wrath of God being poured out on the earth at the very end during the last 7 years of tribulation. Does that make sense? And that's what Revelation is about. And that's chapters 4 through 18. That basically is all of it. Now, in that, there's some little breaks where you pull out of the judgment and God is showing you something that's going on. And a lot of times he puts us right before the throne room of God and we see what's happening in heaven as his wrath is being poured out on earth, which is really, really neat. After chapter 18, the three things that happen at the end, which is what we're going to be looking at from now to Christmas and some of the best parts, is the return of Jesus Christ, the millennial reign of Christ, a thousand-year kingdom where he reigns on earth, but there's still the potential for sin, and then the eternal kingdom that happens after the great white throne of judgment. And that's the best part. I mean, this is where Christ rules and reigns, makes all things new, and it's wonderful. So that's what we're going to be looking at these last few weeks. So that's kind of a sum up of the whole thing, and I'm not going to go into the detail. I was going to kind of go through the chapters, but I really want to jump in to Babylon, but I think it would be good to do this printer front and back. I was like, I'm missing pages of my notes here. So let's start real quick in Revelation. Where is it? You just did 16 in Revelation 16. In Revelation 16, I think it's good to look at this so that you can see what's going on with the whole fall of Babylon. So in Revelation 16, we're, like I said, in that the very, very end of his judgments. We're in the seven bowl judgments. And I know I didn't get to study this with you, but it was exciting reading it and preparing. But basically, the seven bowl judgments are the final wrath of God. This is kind of looking in the seventh trumpet. With the first bowl, there's a plague on those who have the mark of the beast. This is directly what Zechariah 14, 12 through 15 is talking about. And we see it happening here in Revelation 16. The second bowl, the sea is totally destroyed and everything in the sea dies. The third bowl, the fresh water on earth is destroyed. There's no drinkable water. So, I mean, we're down to the end. People, it's an uninhabitable planet after these bowl judgments. Does that make sense? So there, and in fact, if you look at what the word says, he shortens the days of his judgment just so that some can survive. So, I mean, this is the end of the end of the end. The fourth bowl, the sun's heat intensifies and it scorches people on the earth and they're hiding in caves and trying to hide themselves from the scorching heat of the sun. In the fifth bowl, the sun fails and there's darkness over all the earth. And then the sixth bowl, which looks so different because you have all these celestial things happening and nature itself falling apart and creation falling apart. But then the sixth bowl judgment is actually God dries up the Euphrates River and prepares a pathway for the Antichrist and the kingdom, the Babylonian kingdom that we're going to talk about, to come and to fight at the very end. I mean, it's the Lord basically saying, bring it, and Christ is going to return and wipe them out. But the Euphrates rivers dries up, the kings of the earth make their way to come fight against the people of God in their hostile anger and rage. It's what 2 Thessalonians 2 talks about, the deluding influence so that they believe what is false so that all may be judged. Because they pursued their wickedness. It's very reminiscent of what Shane was just talking about with a conscience that, you know, as your mind gets hardened, you go crazy. I mean, sin makes you mad to where you act in ways that are insane. And you see that at the very end, the insanity of sin reaching a pinnacle level to where the people of the earth are coming to kill, to fight God, and to, you know, maybe with some hope, some satanic hope that, you know, they can do what they did the first time and crucify the Christ, you know, but this time they don't have that allotment. The only reason Satan was able to touch Jesus Christ, or men were able to touch Jesus Christ, was because that was the time for God to, for Christ. It was Satan striking the heel moment, and it was the time for God to pour out his wrath on his son. There was a reason people were able to treat Christ the way they treated Christ the first time. They won't have that ability the second time. And so uh, And then in Revelation 16, again, you see the unclean spirits coming out to deceive the people of the earth to come. And then the seventh bowl, the very end of that 16, it says there was an earthquake, hail, destruction of the kingdoms of the world, and then Christ returns. And in fact, I think this is a good exercise if you want to think of it this way. If you want to see the seventh bowl in its entirety, because basically what we're going to study here, Revelation 17, 1 through 19, 10, is again one of those things where you pull out of the chronology of the narrative and you see a big picture sort of thing. It's very reminiscent of, do you remember Revelation 12 through 14, where we're in the middle of those trumpet judgments and all of a sudden we pull out and we see the woman and the beast and the child is born, and it's a picture of the whole history of Israel and Satan's desire to stop Israel, but then Christ comes, and then Christ now is in heaven, and then Satan goes after the people. So God's showing you a big picture of the world system and its hatred of the people of God and how there's always this happening behind the scenes. That's what we're going to do here in the Babylon thing, is basically we're in the middle of these bold judgments, and we're going to pull out, and we're going to see a little bit about what this world system is, this Babylon. Does that make sense? And then we're going to dive back in. So if you want to read the seventh bowl judgment, you would read chapter 16, 17 through 21, skip over to chapter 19, 11 through 21, and it gives you the narrative, if you want to say it that way. So it'd be, look, if you're in chapter 16, it would say, the seventh angel poured out his bowl upon the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple of the throne, saying, it is done. So this is it. Seventh bowl, that's it. It's finished. And there were flashes of lightning, sounds and peals of thunder, and there was a great earthquake such as there had not been since man came to be upon the earth. So this is, it's the whole earth, universe quakes, but earth is shaken in a way. Actually, it says it. So great is the earthquake, was it, and so mighty. Yeah, there it is. The great city was split into three parts. That's Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is split. The cities of the nations fell. So this topples the cities of the nations of the earth. And Babylon the Great, which is what we're about to look at, was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of his fierce wrath. And so 17, 18, and part of 19 are going to be us looking at what does it mean for God to remember Babylon and to pour out the full cup of his wrath on Babylon. Does that make sense? And it says, and every island fled away. These are the islands are basically falling into the sea or disappearing. Mountains were not found. This is an earthquake so catastrophic that it changes the whole topography of the earth, and it creates a place where Zion will rise, and Zion, where Christ will reign for that 1,000 years, will be the highest place on earth, and the people will come to Zion. And so God is rearranging the earth through this earthquake. He says, and then huge hailstones, about 100 pounds each, came down from heaven upon men, and the men blasphemed God because of the hail, because its plague was extremely severe. So again, to the end, sinners in their madness hate God, do not repent, when he's the very one, like Shane just said, that if we turn to, could save us. So then if you move straight from there over to 19:11, you see the narrative continue. And then he says, and I saw heaven opened. So here's the judgment, and then heaven opens. And a white horse, and he who sat on it was called Faithful and True. And righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are, you know who this is, right? This is Christ. This is the heavens open and Christ returning. So judgment's poured out. The people have gathered to fight the people of God that are there in Jerusalem that have been marked, that have been made it through this whole tribulation. And then Christ bursts the heavens open, and he comes, and it's just a slaughter. It says, he has a name written on him, which no one knows except himself. He's clothed in the robe dipped in blood. His name is called the Word of God. And the armies in heaven were clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. From his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations, and he'll rule them with a rod of iron. He treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God. Again, this is it. The Almighty, and on his robe and on his thigh, he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And we talked about that battle. You see it in Revelation 16. We've seen it earlier, I think, in Revelation. I didn't write it down, but I think it's 14. Isaiah 16 and 63 talk about this. And then it says, then I saw the angel standing in the sun. He cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in the mid-heaven, come, assemble for the great supper of God. I mean, this is the battle. An angel calls the birds and says, it's time to eat. Because Christ is just going to wipe them out. Well, I can't. Like I said, I think that was at the end of 14 or in 15, where it talks about the blood was... or is that here? The blood was 200 miles long. We talked about that being the whole land of Canaan, and or from like down in, can't remember the name of the place, but basically it covers the whole, like, the whole land from begin top to bottom of Israel, and Christ just returns and wipes them out. And the birds feast on the flesh of all of those who came to fight God. And it says, so that you may eat the flesh of the kings, and the flesh of the commanders, the flesh of the mighty men, the flesh of the horses, and those who sit on them, the flesh of all men, both free men and slaves, small and great. And I saw the beast, which is the Antichrist, and the kings of the earth, their names, their armies assembled to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. The beast was seized, so this is the end of the Antichrist, and with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence. And deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. And these were thrown alive into the lake of fire. We talked about that when we studied the Antichrist and the false prophet in Revelation 13. A judgment before the great white throne, they were thrown directly into the eternal lake of fire, which means they had to have eternal bodies that would never be consumed. Either in that moment they were transformed so they could be judged forever, or they already had those bodies, which we talked about when we studied that. And it says, and the rest were killed with the sword that came out of the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. That's the end of the seventh bowl. That's the end of the judgment. That's Armageddon. And that's, and then Christ reigns on earth. But we're going to take this Revelation 17:1 through 19:10, and we're going to pull out right when he declares this judgment on the great harlot, the great city Babylon, and before Christ returns and consumes the armies there for that have come to fight against him. And we're going to look at what this Babylon is, because this is going to help us, again, live rightly in this present time. And it's just some really fascinating stuff that the Lord has revealed to us and showed us here. So we're going to basically look at an explanation of Babylon and what Babylon is from beginning to end. And I told you, this is kind of reminiscent of Revelation 12 through 14, where we see what Israel was and how God views this whole history of Israel and Satan's fight against the people of God. And if you look at it, it's very similar. We have two great cities. You have the city of Satan and the city of Christ. The city of Satan is Babylon, and the city of Christ is Israel. What we're going to see today is this whole Babylon thing began in Genesis 11, with the Tower of Babel and with Babel, and it spread throughout the whole earth. It was revived under Nebuchadnezzar, and God used Babylon to destroy the people, the nation of Israel, the temple, the wall, all that stuff under Nebuchadnezzar. And it will be revived again under the Antichrist at the very end. So Babylon has had a purposed history from beginning to end. Does that make sense? And God has told us about this Babylon and what it is. Again, you see something very similar with Israel. It began a seed farm with Abraham. It thrived under Solomon and David. And then it was destroyed, but it stays in remnant form. Now, Israel is a part of the church. They believe through being a part of the church, but there is a future for Israel. It will be revived again. Christ will save the people of Israel. There'll be a national repentance, and the nation itself will thrive again, greater than even the days of Solomon and David. And in fact, that's what Revelation is all about. The whole thing is about Israel and showing us the Old Testament and how the Old Testament must be fulfilled. And I said that last time we studied Revelation, the best way to understand Revelation is to read the whole Bible. If you understand the Old Testament, Revelation makes total sense. If you don't know the Old Testament, you're like, what is this talking about? You know? But Revelation is a explanation. It kind of puts chronological order and a little more definition into many things that have already been proclaimed. In fact, many things in the Old Testament were proclaimed with more detail, but Revelation tells you kind of how or when it will happen. So all that being said, this is one unit that explains the whole detail of the seventh bowl judgment. Robert Thomas, the one of the commentaries there in the back, calls it an expansion or an explanation of the seventh bowl judgment on Babylon. And this Babylon is mentioned six times in Revelation. Every time it's called that great city, or the great Babylon, the great Babylon, the great city Babylon, the mighty city, or the great city Babylon. So it's described as a city called Babylon. And, you know, there's many people that think this is a revived Rome, or they think this is the Muslim Antichrist that's going to come. I mean, there's all kinds of explanations of what people think this could be. And I think you just let it read the way it reads. It's the great city Babylon. And I think it makes a lot more sense if you just let it sit as this is Babylon, and we'll talk about that. Babylon's first judgment was mentioned in Revelation 14, where the angel says, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." And basically what we're going to see here in chapter 17 and 18 is the, chapter 17 is kind of the religious side of this Babylonian city, this Babylonian entity, Babylon. And then chapter 18 is more of the material or economic side of this world system, Babylon, that we're gonna look at. So we're going to look at an overview of this, and we're going to look at other scriptures that have to do with this prophecy, because again, understanding the Old Testament, I think, helps you to get a better picture of what this means. Hopefully we can land on a place that makes the most sense biblically. Now, all that being said, I mean, there definitely are things in here that are hard to understand. It's not like everything, I mean, everything is simple and clear in the sense that God revealed it in a way that we can't understand it. But there's going to be plenty of things. It's like, man, I mean, here's what I think the best explanation is biblically, but we'll see what that means when it happens, sort of thing. So, like I said, we're not going to get detailed. We're not going to do an exposition today into all of 17. We're going to do that next week. I want to give you a foundation to make that explanation make more sense. But let's read these three verses at the very beginning of Revelation 17, because I think it helps us to get behind what's going on here. So Revelation 17, 1 through 3. So this is right after, you know, we just finished the bowl, or we're halfway through that bowl right before Christ returns. It says, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls," we don't know which one, and there's no, I don't think any prophet in trying to figure out which angel this is, "came and spoke with me and said, 'Come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and 10 horns." So I'm going to take these three verses, explain a little bit about what's happening here, and then, like I said, we're going to do a deep dive into this Babylonian thing. So Babylon is described as a harlot here. And again, when it talks about harlotry, there's a connection of harlotry in the Bible, or fornication in the Bible, with idolatry. It's spiritual harlotry, to forsake the one true God and to go after other gods, which aren't gods. So Babylon is called the mother of all harlots in 17:5. And then 18:7, Babylon speaks, is personified, and she speaks. She says, "I sit as a queen, not a widow. I will never see mourning." But we know both from Jeremiah and in 18:8 that in one day she'll be consumed by fire, which again is that return of Christ and the wiping out of this of the kingdom of Babylon. But Babylon itself is the mother of harlots and has cause those who dwell on the earth, all that dwell on the earth, to be drunk with the wine of her immorality, and all the kings, the rulers of the earth, to be committing acts of immorality with the great harlot. And again, this isn't talking about physical sexual immorality. It's talking about idolatry, but it's equating that with, it doesn't mean that there wouldn't be acts of actual physical immorality mixed into this. If you look at all pagan religions, sexual immorality and having temple prostitutes and things like that and sexual things in their religions is prolific. But here we're talking about idolatry, spiritual idolatry. And then when it says an angel takes John into the, it says he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. The wilderness is a desert. So basically, this is John leaving that scene in heaven. He's been in heaven seeing this scene of the seals, trumpets, bowls, and the Spirit takes him to another scene. Does that make sense? And we've seen this before in John 1:10. The Spirit, it says, "I was in the Spirit in the Lord's day, and I heard a voice behind me with sound like a loud trumpet." So, when he was on Patmos, it was the Spirit that allowed him to see Christ there with him on Patmos. So that's the first time we see that. In chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, it says, "Behold, I saw a door standing open in heaven. The voice that I had heard Christ said, like the trumpet said, 'Come up here and I will show you what must take place after these things.'" So talking about the end times. And it says, "I was in the Spirit, and behold, there was a throne in heaven and one sitting on the throne." So when John is taken to heaven to see all of these judgments happening, and see the throne room of God and all these judgments, he was taken by the Spirit there. So I just imagine it like the Spirit of God is taking John to these settings to show him things. It was the same thing in Revelation 21:10. It says that he carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain, and that's where he sees the heavenly Jerusalem coming down and Mount Zion and Christ reigning on earth. But then here in 17:3, he carried me away in a spirit to a wilderness, and he sees this woman sitting on a scarlet beast. So this is just basically the Lord. It's almost like a new scene opens up. Does that make sense? And so here we have this scene. He's in a desert, and he sees this woman on this beast. Now, what this woman on this beast represents is, I think, described in the Bible as the world system. That is always existing, and what God tells us about when he talks about do not love the world and that kind of stuff. The world or the world system, which is presently now spiritually at work and alive in all governing authorities and all religions and all things on this earth, anything that is not 100% submissive to and in alignment with God's truth from his word. And the spiritual forces that are at play in this whole world system. And in the end, the Lord allows this world system to be manifest in a physical earthly kingdom in material form, which is this great city, Babylon. So you see right now that Satan rules this world. He knows it, and Jesus knows it. Even when Jesus is confronted by Satan in Matthew 8 and he's tempted by Satan, one of the things that Satan tells him, it took him to a high mountain. He showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And Satan told Jesus, all these things I will give to you if you fall down before me. This was Jesus' invitation to be the Antichrist. This is Jesus' invitation to inherit through Satan's giving all the kingdoms of the earth. This would have no merit if Satan didn't have some sort of authority or control of these things. And, you know, Jesus being perfectly God and perfectly man didn't submit to probably the greatest temptation. I mean, imagine any person saying, all this belongs to you if you will just worship me. But again, so Satan knows he has some authority. Jesus knows he has this authority. In fact, in John 12, 14, and 16, Jesus himself calls Satan the ruler of this world three times. So even Jesus talks about Satan having some sort of governing and ruling authority over this world or this world system that is at work currently at that time when Christ is on earth. In Ephesians 6:12, Paul, so this is after the resurrection of Christ, Satan is still in control. On the cross, Christ conquered sin and death. Christ, if you want to say, took the keys of death from Satan, and he rules and reigns, but the work is not finished. He will return, what we just saw, and wipe out the whole evil world system, the Antichrist and all of that, cast Satan into hell for 1,000 years. But currently, even after the resurrection of Christ, Ephesians 6 tells us, our struggle is not with flesh and blood, it's against rulers, against powers and world forces of darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. So there are authorities and powers, there's control of a system that exists spiritually that you may not be able to discern with your eyes outside of the effects of it. You see it in the evil of our culture. You see it in the sinfulness of false religions that pull people away from God. You see it in the wickedness of man and murder and rape and all these wicked things on earth. You can see its effects, but you don't see a physical kingdom, but it's at work. 2 Corinthians 4:4, Paul says, the God of this world blinds the minds of the unbelieving so they cannot see the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Again, there's something at work blinding those who don't believe. And in the one working, it's called the God of this world. In 1 John 2:15 through 17, John warns us, these are Jesus' words, do not love the world nor the things in the world. If you love the world, the love of the Father is not in you. So there's a line between the world and Christ's kingdom, the system that makes up this world and those who belong to Christ. He says the world is passing away, its lusts are passing away, but the one who does the will of God lives forever. In John 15, Jesus says, if the world hates you, know it hated me first, or hated me before it hated you. So again, there's something to this world. He says, if you were in the world would love its own. But because you're not of the world, I chose you out of the world. Because of this, the world hates you. So the world, the system, hates Christ and hates all those who belong to Christ. There's a constant animosity and hatred. And if we reject Christ for the world, then it not only reveals what we truly are made out of and who we truly belong to, but it's a sad statement. In 2 Timothy 4:10, Paul talks about his friend Demas, who was there. You know, at the end of Colossians, he talks highly of Demas. But then by 2 Timothy, as Paul's dying, Demas, it says, having loved this present world, has deserted me. So Demas, who looked like a follower for a little while, deserted the faith, it looks like, because of his love for this present world. There's something in this world, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the mind, the boastful pride of life, that appeals to the flesh of all man. And in the end, it's a choice. Are you going to submit to Christ, follow Christ, and forsake this world? Give up your life here to have eternal life, or will you cling to this life? You know, and it's one or the other. Satan is always at work in the world. In 1 John 4:3-6, he says, "This is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you heard that is coming." So he said, John's basically saying, "I know you know that the Antichrist is coming. The spirit of the Antichrist is at work currently." So there is a physical, the Antichrist coming, who will be the ruler of the world. Does that make sense? That Satan will give his authority to, and we've talked about that in Revelation 13. But the spirit of the Antichrist is always at work, and it's behind all of these things. It says, and I think this is the mystery of Babylon the Great that we're going to talk about. He says, you are from God, little children. You've overcome them, because greater is he, Christ, who is in you than he who is in the world, Satan. But, he says, they, those who are not part of the church, are from the world. Therefore, they speak like they're from the world. So they're from the world, so they speak like the world. And the world listens to them because they are speaking the same language. And he says, we are from God, and he who knows God listens to us. He who is not from God does not listen to us. And by this, we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. The spirit of truth speaks the words of God. Those who are of the truth and of the spirit of truth hear the words of God, listen to the words of God, speak the words of God, submit to the words of God. Those who are of the spirit of the error, the spirit of the Antichrist, hear the words of the world, they speak the words of the world, they listen to the words of the world, and they do not accept the words of Christ. It's just that simple. And you can't have both. You can't have one foot in both. It's one or the other. And so today we're talking about this system, Babylon, that is out there spiritually currently, that has always been here from the very beginning, right after the flood, and that will culminate in a physical kingdom at the very end that the Antichrist will be in control of, and that will cause the kings of the world to unite together to come and to fight the people of God in Jerusalem at the very end, which is the Battle of Armageddon. Does that make sense? It is spiritual, but there is a physical manifestation of this. In the end, the Antichrist will be allowed to reign as the true ruler of the earth. I always think of it as Satan will whisper those same words he whispered to Jesus in Matthew 4:8 to somebody else, and they'll say, yes, sir, you know, and bow down before him, and they'll become the Antichrist, whoever that is. It doesn't say it's going to happen that way, but that's the gist. Robert Thomas, again in his commentary in the back, says, this system had its beginnings on the plain of Shinar through the work of Nimrod, and will reach its pinnacle there in that same place just before the second advent. And I think that's a good way to say it. What began in Babel thousands of years ago will culminate again in the same place before the return of Christ. And I think that's what this is talking about. So I think you interpret Revelation 17 and 18 like everything else. It is a vision. It is something he's taken away in a desert, showing him a vision of things. But it has a literal meaning. This is truly Babylon. It's a real city. It's a real city in the Middle East, and I believe it's going to be where Babylon is. Babylon can easily be established again. In fact, I can't tell you all this because it's just going to waste time. You should go look it up. Actually, I think I did have one slide, but there was a dude between 1904 and 1914 named Robert Caldaway, who began to excavate Babylon and found the remnants of Nebuchadnezzar's old city and all that. Ever since then, there's been a drive to rebuild Babylon. Saddam Hussein was huge into this, and he was pouring all of his efforts he wanted to be the basically reincarnated Nebuchadnezzar. He wanted to be Nebuchadnezzar part two. And if you see some of the works that he's already done over there, it's great. But it's not just Saddam Hussein, a madman who started doing this. The world, I didn't write it down, there's a group called the World Historical Fund or something like that, and they even have money backed up by the U.S. Embassy, and they're putting money into this to rebuild Babylon. Now, for tourist stuff, but it's paving the way for this. I think they're just paving the way for what we're about to see here. So to think of of Babylon reemerging and being rebuilt, and they're reviving the spiritual parts of it. Saddam Hussein was very into the spiritual aspects of this Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar did the same thing when he rebuilt Babylon and reestablished it back in the day. He brought back a lot of the pagan stuff from early Babel. So I'm telling you, not only is there a world system, but there is a drive by mankind to revive Babylon. And I think it's just playing out what Christ is talking about here in Revelation. So before we go too deep, though, let's look at this stuff. All right, so you got Babylon. We read Revelation 7, and I actually had slides for all that stuff I just said to you, and I forgot to show it to you. here we go, the beginning, the Tower of Babel. All right, so if you guys read the story of the Tower of Babel? All right, so John MacArthur calls the Tower of Babel history's first great humanistic effort. Robert Thomas calls it the city where false religion began. Basically, they built a monument to themselves. They exalted themselves to make a name for themselves. It was a material city. It had a religious center. The Tower of Babel would have been that center of worship in this ancient city. It was a tower to heaven. It was meant for worship. It wasn't like a capital building. You know what I mean? To read the narrative, basically Genesis 11, 1 through 9 says, "Now the whole earth," this is after the flood, by the way, and if you think about it, this is not too long after the flood, about 100 years, because the person that kind of would have led this stuff would have been Nimrod, who had been the great-grandson of Noah. And so if you look at the times of the genealogies of all we have is Shem, but we're looking at maybe 100 years after the flood. So people would have known and remembered the judgment of God. It says, "Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words, and it came about as they journeyed east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. And they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.' And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. And they said, 'Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach to heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name, otherwise we'll be scattered abroad over the whole face of the earth,'" which was God's command. They were supposed to spread out over the face of the earth. And they're like, we need to rebel against God's command, build a city and a tower for ourselves, make up our own religion, if you want to say it that way, and make a name for ourselves here. Otherwise, God's going to ruin what we want. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower the sons of men have built. And says, the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they began to do. And now nothing which they pursue to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language so they will not understand one another's speech." This wasn't, God's not afraid. This wasn't the Lord being like, they're going to ruin my plans. This is the Lord seeing basically what he just destroyed at the flood that took 1,500 years to culminate in the worldwide judgment of God immediately blossom and begin to work again after the flood. And the confusing of the languages and the spreading out of the nations is going to slow down the speed that we as humans rebel against God in united effort. You know what I mean? And that's also going to spread this evil throughout the world, but this is the Lord's grace and mercy mixed into his judgment, which is always what we see with God. So the Lord scattered them abroad there on the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. So, when God confuses their language in judgment, not only did he stop the rebellion immediately, but he allowed that rebellious seed to spread over the face of the earth. And this is where the beginning of all nations, all religions, and all languages are rooted in Babel. Does that make sense? So you wonder, you know, let me not move too far ahead. Henry Morris, in his commentary, said, "With this confusion of tongues and the resultant dispersion, the religious system was carried by the scattering tribes into every region of the world. Each had its own cultural distinctives, and the names of the pantheon of gods and goddesses were different because the languages were different, but the basic system was still the same everywhere. This is the reason why every nation or every tribe of the past or the present has a religious system, which is fundamentally," now he expanded this a lot more in his commentary, but let me just tell you the names. "Each religious system is either fundamentally pantheistic, polytheistic, evolutionary, animistic, spiritistic, astrological, and idolatrous. They all have roots in the same thing. Even modern evolutionary scientism is nothing but the same ancient paganism in a more sophisticated garb." Do you understand that? Evolutionary thought is not is not some sort of scientific study. It's just paganism. It's ancient paganism, like everything else, that's just infiltrated not only our culture, but the whole world. All religions and philosophies except those founded on special creation as revealed in Genesis worship and serve the creation instead of the creator. Again, there's not a lot of difference between evolution and Hinduism. They're very similar. Thus have all the inhabitants of the earth been made drunk by the wine of Babel's primeval fornication, as Nimrod chose Satan rather than God. So when you read in Revelation 17:2, that all the kings of the earth have been drunk with her immorality, and all the people of the tribes of the earth are intoxicated by her immorality, that's what it's talking about. This began at Babel, and it's just been permeating the earth for 4,000 years. And it will culminate in one ruler that will unite it all against Christ at the very end, because that's always the spirit of the world system. It's always against Christ, always against his word, always against his people. In fact, it'll talk about the great harlot Babylon, who's drunk on the blood of the saints. All religions, including false Christian religions, always persecute and martyr the people of God, including the Son of God himself. You see it in the Old Testament, you see it with Christ, you see it in the New Testament, and you see it in the current church. This is just what's behind this world system. And in the end, it will be manifest in the city of Babylon. So, all that being said, Genesis 10 tells us a little bit about the person who was behind Babylon, and is a guy named Nimrod. And if you've ever studied Nimrod, anybody studied Nimrod? I know sometimes I act like a Nimrod, but have any of you guys ever studied Nimrod in the Bible? There's not much there, but there's some fascinating stuff, especially historical. And this is where I can get off subject and too deep, and I'll just point you to books in the back because it gets exciting. But Genesis 10, 6 through 12, so this is right before the narrative on Babylon. It says, the sons of Ham, which was one of the sons of Noah that was on the boat, were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. The sons of Cush were Seba, Havilah, I did not name, I'm glad I didn't name my kids these things. Anyway, let's move forward. Now, Cush became the father of Nimrod. Nimrod became a mighty one on the earth. You see this word mighty over and over. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, which is what Babylon became. Erech, which is the ancient Sumerian city of Uruk. Akkad, or which is where the Akkadian Empire came out of, where Sargon the Great and all of that, and Kalna in the land of Shinar, which is old Samaria. So this is the beginning. This is like the beginning of the civilizations of mankind. I mean, this is even where secular historians say the civilizations arose from. And Nimrod biblically has something to do with this. All right. It says, from that land he went forth to Assyria and built Nineveh and Rehoboth-ir, which is basically a huge square that was in ancient Nineveh, and Kala, which is called today, that city is called Nimrod. So it's modern Nimrod. And Rezin, which is basically an aqueduct or a canal between Nineveh and Kala, that is the great city. So all that being said, Nimrod was behind a lot of stuff, behind the establishment of Assyria. He had something to do with ruling Babel and establishing all these cities that all became ancient empires. These are all historical places you can go and study, and they were the main empires of the beginning of mankind. And Nimrod had something to do with a lot of this stuff. Now, all that being said, secular historical historians, I think, try to squash this whole study of Nimrod. But there's different approaches on who Nimrod is. Some identify Nimrod as a god. They talk about him being the Mesopotamian Ninutra or Marduk, which we'll talk more about that in a second. Some describe Nimrod as basically a legendary Mesopotamian hero. This is just a story. He's not a real person. And they believe that he is the person in the story of Gilgamesh and things like that. And then others say Nimrod, you can equate him with a historical personage, as an actual person. Many believe he was Sargon the Great from Akkadia that basically went and started conquering all these nations, bring them all together in one world power. I have pictures again. Man, I keep forgetting my pictures. If he was Sargon the Great, some believe that he was Tukulti Ninurta of Assyria. The name means my trust is Ninurta, which is God of Assyria. This is a person that called himself the King of Kings and tried to conquer all of those nations and bring them together again in one power. And then there's another king in this region during this time called Nazimarutash. He was a Kassite king of Babylonia. He proclaimed himself to be the king of the world and conquered a bunch of these nations at that time. Most popular suggestions for Nimrod's identification, as well as some as their respective representatives, include all, you know, again, I'm not going to go through all these different names, but people try to figure out who this Nimrod was. If you look at some of the things that talks about who Nimrod was here, he was definitely the leader of this empire and this religion. I think we can look at it biblically, and he foreshadows the end, the Antichrist at the end that unites the world, conquers things, and begins a religion to exalt himself. So there's definitely correlation between him and the Antichrist. There's a guy named Enrique Baez who has done a huge study on Nimrod, both looking at his name in the Hebrew and looking at the etymology of his name and looking at different world histories to try to figure out more about him. And I'm just going to throw a few of these things out real quick because we got to keep moving. But Nimrod is characterized as the first that is the mighty of the earth. Now, what's neat about that is this word Gibor in the Hebrew, right here. And this is the exact same way this word is used to describe power, might, and sovereignty. It's used to describe the mighty God in the Old Testament. It's also the same word used in Genesis 6:4 to talk about when the Nephilim came into the sons of men, and the mighty ones of the earth were born. And so it's describing Nimrod as like one like that. Not that he was one of those kinds, those were wiped out of the flood. But Nimrod was the first, the mighty ones of the earth, the ones that were that ruled with power. It's used in 1 Samuel 2 and Psalm 33 to talk about mighty leaders, Ezekiel 32 to talk about the mighty God, Isaiah 9 and 10 to talk about, that's the mighty God. The other is the like a valiant soldier or a powerful hero. So the idea here is this is someone with power and might. And every time it talks about Nimrod, it's never in a good sense, you know? It's not the power and the might like God who does all things for good. But Nimrod, it always conveys the idea of some sort of violent or tyrannical rule or power. His success was probably founded in violent rule, but he was very powerful. It's always seen as a negative power, both historically and biblically. Now, something else that's unique to his name, if you look at his name, Nimrod here is the three of the consonants are the same consonant used or word for to rebel in the Hebrew. Maret. I can't remember how you say it. Nimrod. Let's see. Wow, I already moved. But anyway, so it built into his name, which could be why he's called Nimrod biblically, is the word rebel. Now, the same thing, when you go back and you look at ancient Babylonian history, the patron god or the main god of Babylon was Marduk, which was the god of creation in Babylonian history. And his name is built into that too. It's the same, you got Nimrod and you got, you know, the word rebel in the Hebrew Marduk is basically it looks like half of Nimrod's name with an ending on the end. And so there are people that believe that basically he was deified as a god in Babylonian history and worshipped as a god, and this whole story of Marduk is basically tells about Nimrod. Marduk was also a character in the Babylonian epic, the Enuma Elish, which is the epic of creation. He was the hero in that, and he is the one that creates all things, and he is the creator of all of the universe. And again, if this Nimrod was this powerful ruler that wanted to exalt himself and build a tower to heaven and create a false religion and deify himself, it would make sense that they began to worship who he was. Now again, it doesn't mean that we can nail all this down and say this is what it is, but the point is behind a lot of this stuff is this deification of someone who the best biblical answer would be this Nimrod person who was a tyrannical ruler that tried to defeat all the kingdoms of that region, bring them all together under one rule, build a tower to heaven to exalt and make a great name for himself. And then when the spread of everyone from Babel, these stories begin to go out from there of this ruler, this one that was all powerful on the earth, and God had to stop him. You know what I mean? So it's easy to see the seeds of what could become false religion and world religions from there. All that being said, Nimrod went on to form many kingdoms. We know that for sure biblically. All of these kingdoms were propagators of false religion. And all the, you know, from Assyria to Babylon to the Akkadian Empire and all of them, this is where we get many of the early false gods that have, we still have an understanding of these gods, and they're worshipped by different names in the Greek culture and the Roman culture. Nebuchadnezzar, like I said, during the Babylonian time, brought all these gods back to the remembrance of people's minds, and I think that seeped into the Greek and the Roman culture. Marduk from the Bible is the equivalent of Zeus in Greek mythology. They're the same god, different name. And so, again, you know, maybe it had its origins in this person, Nimrod, from back in the day. If it didn't, that's fine. It's not like we got to nail that down. But the point being is this Nimrod was the establisher and the ruler, it looks like, of this kingdom Babel, which was an affront to God. It united the world to rebel against God, to not spread abroad, to make a name for themselves, to build a tower to heaven. And then God stopped it, and they spread out from there. And that could be how the beginning of these false religions. Like I said, this is Marduk in the a depiction of who he is. His animal was the dragon, and so that was what he was known for. And actually, when I told you, this German archaeologist, Robert Coldaway, when he started excavating Babylon, one of the things that they found, they unearthed the remains of the Ishtar Gate. The Ishtar Gate was this big gate that went into Babylon. There was a small gate and a large gate. And it was one of the seven wonders of the world before it was destroyed. And on this gate, and I didn't have time to get into all these different gods, but it was fascinating, are these three gods, all of which came out of that region at that time from these different nations that Nebuchadnezzar brought to the center of worship. Ishtar, which was known as the lion, she was the goddess of sex, fertility, and war. Marduk, which is the dragon, he was the god of all creation. And Adad, the bull, was the weather god. And these were the three gods exalted by Nebuchadnezzar, worshipped by Nebuchadnezzar. In fact, it was the Israelites that were worshiping Ishtar and into actual physical sex or immorality and fornication in their worship Jeremiah, in the prophecies of Jeremiah, he tells them to stop worshiping the queen of heaven. Ishtar was known as the queen of heaven. And they and worship God, repent, return to God. But they said, no, every time we try to worship God, things go bad, so we're going to continue to worship the queen of heaven. And they willingly choose Ishtar over God. And that's part of his judgment on Israel at the time. But all that came through Nebuchadnezzar and his influence on this region, bringing these gods back to central worship. And so, all that being said, that's just, like I said, there's more to it, and there's some really good stuff in the Henry Morris commentary about there. But all that being said, Henry Morris kind of sums it up by saying, Nebuchadnezzar himself had been imminently concerned with the restoration of Babylon's earlier culture and religion. He rebuilt the temples. He reinstituted the ancient worship of the older Babylonians at the time of Hammurabi and earlier. Nebuchadnezzar reestablished the worship of Marduk as the chief god of the Babylonian pantheon. That's the wrong quote. Anyway. It's in. It's called the Revelation Record. It's by Henry Morris. It's a commentary on Revelation, but he gets into the historicity of Babylon and all this sort of stuff. So all that being said, when it talks about the nations being drunk on the wine of her immorality, it's not talking about Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar just revived what was already there to begin with, and just made it more prominent, which probably helped, you know, filter it into the Greek and the Roman cultures which came after him. But this is in all world systems around the world. And I want to tell you a little bit more about that in a second. But he goes on to say, this is not the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar that made all the nations drunk with the wine of her spiritual fornication. Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon did transmit much of its culture into Medo, Persia, Greek, and Roman empires, which succeeded it. And it was of profound importance in the history of Israel, since it was Nebuchadnezzar who carried them away into the 70-year Babylonian captivity. But when we think about Babylon, and we talk about this spiritual Babylon, and this Babylon that's revived at the end, you got to get all the way back to Babel and know that this thing started there, and it has infiltrated the whole world. And it's going right now, and it's just a matter of just God's timing to bring it together to where Babylon is rebuilt, and this physical city manifests what spiritually has always been there. A deep hatred of God and the people of God with a murderous lust to destroy anything that is of God. Again, you see a little bit of that play out with Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. It was Nebuchadnezzar, and I don't have time to go through all of it. In 722, Assyria started destroying the people of God. 605, 597, and 586, Nebuchadnezzar wiped out Israel, or wiped out the northern kingdom. And that's what this, I was quoting this was from. When Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, what it transmitted, it must have first received from its own progenitors. Furthermore, the great number of similarities between the idolatrous worship of the ancient Chinese, the Hindus, the Incas, and other people far removed from Babylon with the Babylonian worship could not have come from Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. In other words, this stuff is deep-rooted, and you see it worldwide. And it happened before 605 BC, 586 BC. Yeah, yeah. That's right, and that's what we're saying. When we talk about all the world and the kings of the world and the nations of the world being drunk on the wine of her immorality, you got to get behind that all the way back to the very beginning. That's what's been happening in this whole world system from the very, very beginning. In fact, this is a neat study. Bodie Hodge, in his book, and it's back there in the back, he did a study on Babel and all the different things about Babel. But he says, ziggurats, pyramids, mounds, and the like have been found in many parts of the world, from Mesopotamia to Egypt to South America. The ancient Chinese built pyramids, and Mississippian culture built mounds. Pyramids are classified slightly different from ziggurats, as are mounds, but the similarities are striking. They're all centered around worship. They're all centered, they're these pyramids and mounds, and you can see them all over the world, everywhere from Mexico to China to even here in the Americas with the Indian mounds and things like that. And they're all centered around worship. And they're all, you know, when they talk about the Tower of Babylon, if you look back historically, there was a tower in Babel all the way up to Alexander the Great's time. Alexander the Great wrote about the Tower of Babel being there as this like ziggurat tower. So everything from the Egyptians to all these different people, you see similarities in the structures of how they worshiped throughout the world. And creationists, people that believe things came from Babel, say this is basically as the Lord spread out the earth, they took this false religion with them wherever they went, and they just replicated it in different forms with different languages, different names of gods, but the same idea throughout the whole world. And in fact, this is a crazy one. This one right here is actually, it's called Burs Nimrud. It's over in Babylon, and it's called, that means the Tower of Nimrod. And so it was one of these ziggurats built to worship Nimrod himself. So again, I'm not trying to be like, you know, I'm just saying this is deep-rooted, and it comes from the very beginning at Babel. And in the end, all of these world, you know, Paul calls false religions the doctrines of demons. There's something behind all of this. There's the spirit of the Antichrist that's always at work. There's the world system that's always at work. These things always, always work against the people of God and the things of God. If you go read in Jeremiah 50 and 51, Isaiah 13, and Isaiah 45 through 48, you see prophecies of the destruction of Babylon. They're all talking about Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. But there's things in these prophecies about the destruction of the Babylon that did not happen yet, to the extent that these prophecies say. Does that make sense? And it's very reminiscent of things that he says to Israel. There's things that God said to Israel that he promised Israel, and there's been a partial fulfillment, but the full fulfillment has not happened. It's the same stuff with Babylon, and it makes you look at it and go, there must be a future Babylon, an actual city of Babylon, where these prophecies can have their full fulfillment. And I believe that there is a judgment of the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar's day, but there's a judgment of the end Babylon that we see there in Revelation. You see it in Jeremiah 50 and 51 are the two places you see the most. It mentions Babylon 149 times in Jeremiah, and it talks about the near and future destruction of Babylon. Henry Morris says, in context, these prophecies in Isaiah and Jeremiah concerning Babylon have been directly primarily against the Babylon of their own day, so Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. To a considerable degree, these prophecies have been fulfilled as the Persians and later the Greeks invaded and sacked Babylon. Now, however, John learns that these prophecies, like numerous other Old Testament prophecies, have both a near and a distant fulfillment, with the first as a type and the precursor of the last. Again, just like we see with Israel. Babylon may have seemed weak and impotent in John's day, but she was not dead. And her unclean and idolatrous ways have survived through other nations, and she has contaminated. And she herself, through them, will one day revive in greater wickedness than ever. So all that being said, when we talk about this Babylon that we're going to talk about the next couple of weeks and see what it looks like, don't think of it like a revived Rome. It's not the Muslim system of worship that, you know, it's the Muslim Antichrist, and he sounds much like the Muslim Christ that sounds much like the Antichrist of the Bible. It's like those can be snippets of the whole, but the whole is much bigger than that. This is something that has been going on throughout history. I'm going to leave you with this quote. John MacArthur says, throughout history, Babylon has been an important center of false religion. In the end times, false religion will come back to where it started. The devil who deceived the people at Babel and from there launched false religion over the earth will deceive the world once again. During the tribulation, all the world's diverse false religions will be reunited into one. That's one great world religion. Only religion can unite the world in the most compelling way, and only religion can transcend the physical, geographical, historical, economic, and cultural barriers to world unity. And I think in Revelation 17, that's what you're going to see. You're going to see the religious aspect of Babylon. In Revelation 18, you're going to see the actual nation, the commerce and that kind of stuff. But you're going to see those working together to reunite this city and for this to be a central place at the end times that unites the world to come and to fight against the people of God there in Jerusalem. And that makes Revelation 17 and 18 so much greater and so much more clear. So I just thought that'd be a good place to start. So next week we'll get into Revelation 17, see what the words actually mean. But let me pray for us because we gotta head.